We'll now ask Brother Brian to lead us in the consideration of Isaiah 25 to the subject, Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth.
O Yahweh, says Isaiah in verse 1, it's his own statement. Did you notice that? O Yahweh, this is Isaiah speaking unto his God. Thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will praise thy name. For thou hast done wonderful things. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. You know, one of the lovely facets of this study is to try and find Isaiah himself. If you come back to the 24th chapter and verse 16, do you remember how that in the midst of that statement about the glory of God's name being declared in the lands of the Gentiles, there was again this personal statement of Isaiah, verse 16, chapter 24. From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. And so that section, verse 13 to 16b, closes. But then we have an altogether different sentiment, didn't we? The theme so greatly changes. But I said, my leanness, woe unto me, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. He's overcome by the wickedness of the world. That's Isaiah. This is not just words on paper. It's not just a man standing up with his voice in the street and unaffected by what he's saying. He's in it, isn't he? There's a power in that. We ought not to miss that. In chapter 2, we had an earlier evidence of the spirit of Isaiah. Here's a little project, young men. Young girls, here's a little project for the curious and interested scholar. Go through the book and make a list of all the little statements that are Isaiah's own. What a lovely study that would be. And you know, you'd know more about Isaiah from that than almost anyone would know. It's all there. The passions, the thinking, the mentality of Isaiah is there if we want to know him. What a lovely thought. A wonderful quest to get to know Isaiah. He lived 2,700 years ago. But we can get to know him. In chapter 2, magnificent statement. Absolutely magnificent. About the house of Yahweh on the top of Mount Zion, verses 2 to 4. And to it are coming all people to learn of God's ways. Imagine that, my dear brothers and sisters. If he was excited in his day, how would you feel about that being stated in our day? People can do nothing on Sunday that's got to do with God's name. Nothing can they do. Do everything else. But as far as going to his place of learning, not the slightest bit interested. Come ye and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh. And Isaiah heard all of that. He saw in verse 4 the end of war and the coming in of eternal peace. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Verse 5. O house of Jacob, this is Isaiah, come ye and let us walk in the light of Yahweh. Isn't that lovely? He doesn't read verses 2 and 4 as though it's, you know, the readings have to be done. He reads it, and when he reads it, it fills his heart. And he says, look, if that's what God is going to do, then what are we doing here, Judah? What are we so slothful about the things of God? Why such indifference? Come ye, O Judah. O house of Jacob, come and let us walk in the light of Yahweh. If that's what's going to happen in the future and all nations are going to go up, they're going to walk unto the house of God, saying, come ye, verse 3. He picks up the sentiment of that. They will walk in his ways, verse 3. See? Come ye, he says in verse 5, because in verse 3 the Spirit said that in the future many people shall go and say, come ye. Isn't that lovely? Absolutely lovely. He picks up the whole spirit of that prophecy. It's not just words, is it? But he's involved in what he's saying. Oh, Judah, he says, come on. Let's respond to the goodness of God. If that's coming, then let's get in the theme of it now. That's how we should be in our Bible class. sitting up and alert to all the beauties that are in the Word of God. Isaiah 6 and verse 5. Inspiring character, Isaiah. I suppose, my dear brothers and sisters, when you think about it, you'd expect that he would be, wouldn't you? Isaiah, salvation of Yah. You wouldn't expect God's going to give that very precious message to somebody who was sort of laissez-faire about things, would you? You wouldn't expect that. It'd have to be someone who would respond and was able to, as a right medium, take that message to the people. In Isaiah 6 and verse 5, when he heard about the glory of Yahweh, holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts, he saw the King in his glory, as John chapter 12 paraphrases that. And it says in verse 5, then said I, woe is me, woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of hosts. Isn't that beautiful again? Passionately involved, a bit like Peter. You know, Peter was told by the Lord as one of the fishermen, cast your net on the other side. And they did. They'd been out all night, remember? And when they did, the thing was overloaded. And they caught the other boat over. And they caught the fish in the net. And they began to pull it in. And it just about weighed down the boats. And every man was needed on deck, but not Peter. He hops into the sea and he comes into the Lord. And he says, depart from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man. He saw the point of it, didn't he? Amidst all of the incredible business that was required to get those fish into the boats and all the excitement of it, Peter's mind had gone to the personal situation. This man, if he knows where fish are, knows where my mind is, and he knows what I do. And so he had turned that spectacular event into a personal inspection. That's the same. Same spirit here in Isaiah. He saw the glory of Yahweh and he turned it to personal introspection. Woe is me, for I'm undone. A man of unclean lips, dwelling in a nation of unclean lips. You know, that's how we've got to be towards the things of God in our readings together of the scriptures. They're alive, aren't they? How do we deal with the scriptures when we're dealing with our children? Our kiddies need to feel that when we're dealing with the readings in our home. Fathers, mothers, we're going to make it live, don't we? Those little children will go to school with that fired up in their mind if we impress with that. Otherwise, we'll go to them to school full of, you know, arithmetic and geography and algebra and all sorts of other things, won't they? They'll think that's the dominant thing. But if we put into their mind something that is powerful and thrilling, that is about the things of God, that's what they'll take in their mind. Becomes then an effective power. Isaiah is a very wonderful person. In Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 11, he's told terrible things that are going to come upon Israel about God's blinding of his people. Make the heart of this people fat and make their ears heavy, verse 10. Shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and convert and be healed. Then said I, Lord, how long? He wasn't a hard man, was he? He was touched by the plight of Israel. Wasn't aloof from them. Lord, how long? Until the cities be wasted and so on. There's Isaiah, chapter 8, verse 18. Verse 16. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. There's a division of peoples because of the message of the gospel. Some accept, some reject. Some will rise, some will fall. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait upon Yahweh that hideth his face in the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Who's that speaking? It's Isaiah. As he gives the very message, he stands clear. As for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. That's what he's saying. See verse 18. Behold, I and the children whom Yahweh hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from Yahweh of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Nothing's going to touch him. He makes a personal stand. I will wait upon Yahweh. There's going to be many stumble and fall, verse 15. There's going to be others among whom the testimony of God will be bound up, verse 16. Well, where do you stand, Isaiah? Here's where I am. I will wait upon Yahweh that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. I will go and find him if he turns his face from Israel. Tremendous person. A straightforward course Isaiah had, and his children, verse 18, with him. Now, it's that kind of a policy, my dear brothers and sisters, that's dreadfully needed in the latter days. Tremendous requirement of exactly that in our home and family lives. A policy that is unequivocal to our children, and they can see that direction and clear and sharp. You know, it is my opportunity from time to time to move around, and I can only say that I am increasingly moved, my dear brothers and sisters, and I come home to, you know, to say that I'm increasingly moved with the need for us to consolidate what we have and to be strong in the policies that we have had over the years, to be clear and unequivocal in our love for the truth. Now, Bible classes is a very great and important part of that instruction, to keep the tone of our class up, the instruction level of it up, to have our young ones interested as Bible students going home to do some work, to think about their scriptures, not just turning up at a meeting and that's all the time, they really get down to their Bibles, but, you know, get your minds down to it. There's a tremendous need, and that need's going to grow and grow as the time between here and our Lord's coming is upon us. It may not be very long, however long it is, it's going to grow. The power of that is going to grow. And we need to have policies like Isaiah, who said, I and my children are for signs and for wonders. They were with him in the work, and they were named, weren't they, after the things of God. One meaning that a remnant would return, and the other meaning that the certainty of God's judgments was there. Hasten the spoil and hasten the prey. So both aspects of the message were declared by the children on the right and the left of the prophet. So he and his family lived that message, and so must we. So we come back now to our beautiful 25th chapter. I just asked a question of myself when I read that verse 1, and I thought to myself, how many times in my life have I really said something like verse 1? How many times, my dear brothers and sisters? You read it carefully. It's a beautiful expression, isn't it? O Yahweh, thou art my God. I will praise thy name. He's overcome, is he not? Absolutely overcome. Why is this sudden expression of praise and thanks to God? Well, he says, for thou hast done wonderful things. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. It's an interesting expression. Thou hast done wonderful things. Just a little secret. The word wonderful things is not really in the plural. It's just in the singular. As a matter of fact, it's the word pele, which means a wonder. All right? And it's related to the word which we often have described as, or take for example, Psalm 118. It has the sense of something beyond what man can do. Psalm 118, verse 22-23. The stone which the builders refused has become the headstone of the corner. This is Yahweh's doing, and it is marvellous in our eyes. Now, that word marvellous is related to our word. It's the word pala. As you know, the vowels are the strong point in the Hebrew language. Just for your interest, you'll find it with a little two strongs. And here translated as marvellous. Not marvellous in the sense of we agree with it. Marvellous in the sense of it's beyond us. It's incredulous to us. And that's always the sense that accompanies it. In other words, it's something beyond what man could understand. It's a wonder, see? It's the same idea. Always something beyond what man could do or understand. And it was when Jesus came. They never expected Messiah to come like that. And he was taken by the builders. In fact, he was rejected and he was destroyed by the builders. And this is marvellous in our eyes. He, nevertheless, is the Messiah. They couldn't understand that. And that illustration shows exactly how this word is used in the scriptures. A sense of the unbelievable. You've got it in the 9th chapter, of course, in a very well-known chapter, Isaiah chapter 9. Very well-known expression. Here it's the word pele again. Isaiah 9 verse 6, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Pele, P-E-L-E. I don't know what you do with little things like that, but I tell you what I do, if it's at all helpful. I have over the years, I've put that little Hebrew expression above the word wonderful, you know, with the neat little pens. You can just fit it in there quite neatly. Put it in capitals so you can read it easily. And I've found over the years that's been a really helpful exercise. Not that I'm any Hebraist, and none of us are, I know. But nevertheless, it's sometimes useful, isn't it, to know that there is a linkage in the word, because it helps you to run through the Bible and find that word through the Bible and gives you, therefore, some degree of a feel of that word. And over a number of years, you'll find that that's very helpful indeed. But if you don't put them somewhere, then you never build them up, do you? And where do you put them in your margin? You put them in your margin, sort of getting away and so forth. So if you just pop them above, it can be very helpful. All right, so that's our word pele. Thou hast done wonderful things. Now, if you come back to Isaiah 25, verse 1, you remember that I said it's really in the singular. Thou hast done a wonder, you may well translate that. In fact, that's how it is translated. Thou hast done a wonder. Several of the translations put it exactly that way. For thou hast done a wonder. Isn't that interesting? I suppose there's got to be an echo back to Isaiah 9 verse 6 perhaps, because that is the singular use of pele as well, and of all God's wonders that is the most singular, isn't it indeed? But if we look at the next phrase, thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth, we see that there's really a broad picture that is involved behind this uprising of praise that is in his mind. The reasons for this praise are because of a broad picture of God's doings, of his intentions, of his wisdom, of his word, his declaration, his counsels, his advices. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. And it's very interesting to notice those two words too. They're actually very closely related. The word faithfulness, thy counsels of old are faithfulness. Is the Hebrew word emunah. And the word truth is the word omen. And again, you can see they're related words, aren't they? They're related because here are our vows. All right, all the rest is essentially, there are consonants. All the rest is essentially vowels, and the strength of those two words in the consonants is the same. So in a sense, here's a man overcome, and in his inability to express, as we may well feel sometimes in our prayers, what words do we use to channel such a thought toward God? Here's a man who is excitedly overcome by what God is doing, by his advices, his counsels. When he sees the whole purpose of God, He's overcome, and he says, seeing that's almost the same word, he says, "Thy counsels of old are faithful faithfulnesses." That's a more literal translation of it. Now, you know what the English teacher does with things like that. He says that's alliteration. What's the word I want? Transliteration? No. Illiteration, that's right. Where you sort of repeat the word. I should have asked an English sister, shouldn't I? I would have gotten them to answer immediately. So the English teacher crosses those out. But you see, what I think that we can see from that is that Isaiah is overcome by the wonder of what God has done, and not able sort of to pluck another word, as it were. He emphasizes the one he's using because it so beautifully expresses what he wants to say. And so he alliterates. "Thy counsels of old are faithful faithfulness." I mean, what is faithfulness that's not faithful? But I just want to say it again, says Isaiah. It's like that, isn't it? Sometimes we are like that ourselves. We almost fail to find another word to express how deeply we feel about a matter. And here I think we have a case in point. Well, obviously Isaiah is saying that because of what he's declared in the previous chapter. It's verse 1 of chapter 25, and so obviously it comes after the statement of all that God is doing or is going to do in chapter 24. Now, I wonder how many of us had that kind of reaction, right? How many of us had that kind of reaction when we studied chapter 24? Isaiah's reaction to it was, "Yahweh, thou art my God. This is a marvellous and glorious statement of purpose. I can see that everything that I really worried about has been catered for. You have looked after every situation. The matter is perfectly balanced. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. Everything you said has truly come to pass. You have not forgotten what you said you would do." That's what he's saying, isn't he? All right, how did you get that out of chapter 24? Have you got your sheet? I think it was handed around, wasn't it? Remember chapter 24, just to get the sense of it again. And think as we're doing this. This is a remarkable chapter, wasn't it? Chapter 24, verses 1 to 12, was judgment upon Judah and Jerusalem that would come to its finality when, verse 12, the city was left in desolation, the gates smitten with destruction. When the Romans, finally led by Titus, would ransack that city that had been once a city of faithfulness and truth, but now was left, verse 10, a city of confusion and broken down. Tragedy was going to befall that land because it had broken the everlasting covenant. Verse 5, "The earth also is defiled unto the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant." So the statement about Israel's terrible deficiency and the judgment that God would bring is stated in those first 12 verses. But then there was a surprising change in the chapter. The theme from verse 13 to 16a is altogether different. There is a remnant that are found not just in Judah, but they're found, in fact, throughout the world. "When thus it shall be in the midst of the land," verse 13, "among the peoples, there shall be as the shaking of an olive tree and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done." It's like a gleanings, he says. Sheer Jashub meant a remnant would return. There was always this remnant theme in Isaiah. It's one of the great themes, isn't it, that we found in Isaiah time and time again. There it was. In verse 13. "But they are not found in the land. They shall lift up their voice," for verse 14. "They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of Yahweh. They shall cry aloud from the sea." And do you remember how that the RSV and Rotherham translated that as "from the west," because that's where the big sea was. Or verse 15, "Wherefore glorify ye Yahweh in the fires." And the Revised Standard Version says, "in the east." because that's where the fires of dawn arose, in contrast with the sea in the west. So from both points of the compass, east and west, east that never stops and west that never stops, north stops, south stops. But east and west don't have a point, do they? They just keep on going around the world, from all countries of the world, says Isaiah. We hear this message of glorification unto Yahweh. Verse 15, wherefore glorify ye Yahweh in the east as in the west, even the name of Yahweh, God of Israel, in the isles of the sea, a term always used of the Gentiles. And to put it in very emphatic language, from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory, to the righteous one. Isn't that beautiful? So Israel's terrible day of disintegration would come, but the work of God would go on. And a people in all the different countries of the world, even down to Australia, are going to arise to do what Israel could have done before. And whereas they no longer had mirth, verse 8. There's no merry heart at verse 7. Verse 8, the noise of them that rejoice has ended and the joy of the harp has ceased. Yet around the world there will be others who are lifting up their voice to glorify God. It's a bit like our hymn, isn't it? It's a hymn, is it 321 in the new book, which says about, you know, that as the sun goes around, our brethren in the western skies sort of take up the message, don't they? As the world turns and dawn comes to a different group of brethren and sisters around the world. This has got some of that beautiful sense in it, hasn't it? So, all right, verses 13 to 16a is the opportunity of a remnant from all nations to pick up the theme. There'll be another Israel. The Israel of God, as Paul will call them in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 16, who will pick up what Judah left behind. But then, in verse 16b, the prophet's sentiments greatly changed again. And he's constrained with this terrible message that then comes upon him about another great judgment of God. And it's an inescapable judgment. If you, verse 17, if you flee from the fear, then you'll fall into the pit. And if you scrape out of the pit, then in fact you'll fall into the trap, the snare. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. And there was no way out. Not only was there trouble from every side, but there was trouble, verse 18, from on high. The windows from on high are open, and from underneath one's very feet the foundations of the earth do shake. Every side, up and down, never mind where you go, there is absolutely no escape from this terrible calamity which is coming upon the earth. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly, like an old drunkard, verse 20. It's just rearing to and fro and ready to collapse. And it does. And we found out that that was God's judgment upon the Gentile world. God's judgment upon Israel, verses 1 to 12. God's judgment upon the nations, verses 16b to verse 20. God has got everything under control then, hasn't he? And in his own time, he brings out his judgment as he sees fit. He is not a respecter of persons. He judged his own people first. They first went into captivity, and then he swung the door open to the Gentiles, gave them opportunity. The days of the Gentiles began. But he set a time upon them. He did not leave his people forlorn and hopeless forever. He would eventually, having given the Gentiles opportunity, he would then bring them in again, graft them in again. The boughs would be broken, but they would be eventually grafted in again. It shall come to pass in that day, verse 21, the punishment upon the nations, the binding of their powers, that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. You see, clearly that's not Israel, is it? Alone, it's not. It's a universal application. Verses 16b to 22 is a universal application upon Gentile powers. It's a terrific chapter, isn't it? Everything is there. And my dear brothers and sisters, isn't that really required today? How do you so often feel when you pick up the paper from day to day? Look at today's news. Look at yesterday's. It's really getting amazing, isn't it? Absolutely amazing, the things we are reading in our papers. In Little Adelaide. Well, it's a letter bomb one day. It's a siege the next. It's something or other else some other. It's just getting absolutely unbelievable. Anyone my kind of age just can't hardly imagine to see what a change it is from the circumstances of my own upbringing. One of those events would be an event for the decade. Today it's almost every second week we're coming up with one like that. Now, I'm not exaggerating. That's where it's going. The earth is filled with violence because men honour the flesh. They let it have its way from childhood up. They're getting hold of our children and inducting them with that concept. That's what they ought to do. Express themselves as they wish to express themselves. And we've got to do something about that. It's a very dire consequence that we are coming into. So I can rejoice in the judgments of God, even if with some measure of consternation of our own position. Nevertheless, we can feel the great need for it. He has got everything in control. He has promised these things. He has set them out. The plan is there. And he will balance it. And verse 23, won't forget his promises made to David of old. If the city is left desolation, verse 12, the city where David ruled, on which his seed occupied the throne, yet nevertheless, then the moon shall be confounded, the ecclesiastical system of the earth, and the sun ashamed, all the ruling powers together, ashamed, when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in David's city, in Mount Zion, and in Jerusalem, and not alone either, and before his ancients, his elders, gloriously. Everything is contained, isn't it? There's the perfect balance. When Isaiah looked at that, he said, O Yahweh, thou art my God. I was worried about this, I was worried about that. I read that terrible section about judgment upon Israel, and I wondered, you know, why would the Gentiles then be judged? They're just as bad, they're worse. Well, you've got that in mind as well. He's got the whole picture properly balanced up. And in the end, he doesn't forget anything. He hasn't forgot that he promised to David these things, and he will remember Jerusalem. And what's more, he will remember us before his ancient glories. O Yahweh, thou art my God. See the point? God owns them. He will own his God. They are his elders. What a lovely expression, verse 23. Isaiah responds to that and says, Yahweh, thou art my God. Isn't that lovely? Personal relationship. They're beautiful things. What do you do with little points like that? Just giving a few little clues tonight because I think they're helpful. I ring the word his and I ring the word mine. Link them up together. That's an intention. We miss that, especially because there's a chapter break. But that's a personal response of a servant of God that is overcome by the balance of all that God has done, by the beauty of his overall purpose. Thy counsel of old are faithfulness and truth. Where's another passage like that? Where the whole purpose is looked over, and then the writer, in this case an apostle, stands back and he says, that is marvellous. Where is that? In the New Testament. It's got to be, I suppose, if it's an apostle, isn't it? Where's that passage? First this, then that, and God straightens it all up. And the apostle says, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his counsel and his ways past finding. Where's that passage? Good, thanks, Deb. In Romans chapter 11, you'll be good enough to go to Wales if you keep that up. You only export the best, you know. Romans chapter 11. You've got a chapter so similar to that. He speaks, doesn't he, of the breaking off of the branches, verse 17. The casting away of Israel, verse 15. And then he says, well, if God has cast them away, it's because the Gentiles are able to come in. Well, because of unbelief, verse 20, or verse 19, the branches were broken off, you might say, that I might be grafted in. Well, yes, because of unbelief, they were broken off, and thou standest by faith. These were broken off that you might come in. But verse 21, for if God spared not the natural branches, take heed lest he also spare not thee. And he's able to bring these in again, verse 23, he's able to. God is able to graft them in again. What's more, verse 24, it's a very probable thing that he would. How much more shall these, end of verse 24, which be the natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? For I would not, you brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. So they fell, you came in, God will pick up the branches again, there's every good reason he would, because they all are all said and done, related to the hope of Israel. Why shouldn't he? There's every good reason why he picked them up again and bring them all together. See? And so all Israel, verse 26, shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And so Paul stands back and he says in verse 30, for as ye in times past have not believed God, yet have now obtained mercy through their unbelief, even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy. For God hath concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. Just in their different seasons, in their different eras. Time for the Jews, time for the Gentiles. He's got it all worked out. And he's playing out his purpose. For God hath concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. And so Paul stands back in that and is overcome by it. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. No Jew suspected it to be that way. This is like Isaiah, isn't it? How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counsellor? For who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again. He had the whole thing sewn up beautifully from the very beginning. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. All right, that's a very similar a concept, a very beautiful statement of a similar occasion, or similar set of circumstances. All right, coming back now to Isaiah. Everything is catered for in the picture that has been presented, and there's Isaiah's beautiful response to the wonderful advices and counsels of God. Do you notice too, it's the counsels of old. Don't miss that. They've been there a long time, unchanged. You know, there's nothing in our world that doesn't change almost from day to day, is there? Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. And that's how we need to be, my dear brothers. We don't have to go swinging around, because everybody's changing this and changing that, and changing the way they look and changing the way they dress and changing everything, the way they come to meetings. The whole lot's been changed, isn't it? All around the world. We don't have to be like that. Can be stable and solemn people in our commitments to our way of life. And we need that. We do not need to be swinging around, which only creates instability and uncertainty in the world in the ecclesial world in which we live. We can be hearty and endorse things that are of old. All right. Now, arising then out of this beautiful expression of praise, Isaiah is given a greater and clearer picture of things to come. Have you got your little break up there again? You'll see that chapter 25, verses 2 to 5, says the fall of the city of the nations. Now that's interesting. The fall of the city of the nations. Why would it be so described? Well, look at verse 2. Verse 2 and 3 have no less than four references to the city, for thou hast made of a city an heap. Notice the four. That's related back to the statement of praise of verse 1. So Isaiah's beautiful lifting up of praise, not only for what God had said, but also now what he's going to say. See? Four. Thou hast made of a city an heap, of a defence city a ruin, even a defence city with its great walls and bulwarks, a palace of strangers, of foreigners, to be no city. It shall never be built. And finally, verse 3, therefore shall the strong people glorify thee, the city of the terrible nations shall fear thee. Now you can see there is a real accent upon the city. And that's why we've entitled that, The Fall of the City of the Nations. Four times in those verses, there is a concentration upon the word city. There's a focus, therefore, in verses 2 to 5, it's upon the city of the nations. Now the contrast is clear with chapter 24 verse 23, isn't it? Because he's only just said that in chapter 24 verse 23 about Mount Zion. He shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. And so verses 2 and 3 are a brilliant contrast with that. So also in chapter 25 verse 6, in this mountain shall Yahweh of hosts make unto all people. Verse 7, he will destroy in this mountain. Or again, my dear brothers and sisters, look at chapter 26, verse 1. When the other city's gone, this song is heard. We have a strong city. We have a strong city. Or chapter 26 and verse 5, which again states the bringing down of the great city of the nations. For he bringeth down them that dwell on high. The lofty city, he layeth it low. He layeth it low even to the ground. He bringeth it even to the dust. That's interesting, isn't it? That's why, basically why, in this 24th to 26th chapters, we have a little prophecy, which is more or less circumscribed, which is sometimes called the little apocalypse. There's the overall reason. What's the apocalypse about? Lots of things, okay? But what's the essential thing about the apocalypse? It's Rome versus Jerusalem, isn't it? That's what it is. And finally, you see, when Rome is gone, the Lamb with 144,000 reigning upon Mount Zion. That's the picture which is given. Now here, in Isaiah chapter 24 to 26, you've got Jerusalem contrasted with the city of the nations. Now what is the city of the nations? It's got to be Rome, doesn't it? In the context of Isaiah, it wasn't the first city that was going to come against them, though, wasn't it? What was the first great city that was going to send its legions against Rome? Against Jerusalem. Sorry. Even before Babylon. This is Hezekiah's period. Sorry. The Assyrian coming from his capital city of Nineveh. But the terms of this prophecy can't really refer to the judgment of the Assyrians. It can't really refer to that because although Nineveh was at that stage the greatest city in the world, yet the Assyrian did not actually fulfill verses 1 to 12 of chapter 24, did he? He didn't leave the city in desolation. It was Rome that did that. Babylon came after that in BC 606, and it did indeed destroy Jerusalem, but Jerusalem bounced back. It was not followed by the time of the gospel being found in a remnant all through the world. So the truest application is the judgment upon the city of Rome. And of course, that is by far the city of the nations. For if we were to look, for example, at the period that Babylon reigned,
we might have 200 years. Sorry, not 200 years. 70 years. Or if we looked, for example, at Shushan, you might say, well, that was the capital of the Persians, and it was. But the Persian dominion only lasted for something like 200 years. Incidentally, Shushan was known as Shushan the Palace. And you've got in verse 2, we've got a series of three statements that to make of a city, a heap, of a defence city, a ruin, a palace of strangers to be no city. You think, well, what's it mean, a palace of strangers to be no city? Well, many cities in those times were built as though, you know, it was both the city and the palace. So Shushan the palace, that doesn't really mean, well, it means what it says. The whole city was the palace. The palace was the city. It was called as though the palace was the whole of that city. It was there as a royal city. I suppose that's the sense of it, isn't it? All right. So that's a case in point. And if we then look at the next one, the capital of the Greek Empire was? Capital of the Greek Empire? Athens? You see, that only went for about 200 years approximately too. But when we come to Rome, it begins about BC, we'll say 100. Of course, it was establishing itself over a considerable period of time, but it was already a very great city by BC 100, and it was unbreached until AD 396. Right? It was therefore a city in its own right for 500 years. But more than that, my dear brothers and sisters, even after that time, it continued, didn't it, through its religious influence to occupy another great period of time. For example, the Holy Roman Empire went from AD 800 to AD
very close to AD 1800 when the Pope lost his temporal power.
So that went for another 1,000 years there. We often call it a false millennium. So, you know, Rome has exceeded all the other cities of the nations vastly. And if one city is going to have the title of the city of the nations, then indeed it would have to be Rome. So verse 2 says, it shall never be built. Now let's take those thoughts through and have a look at how the scriptures do really accentuate a city. Book of Revelation. Chapter 18, just a case in point. Revelation 18, verse 2. There's no other equivalent to this city. He cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen. The cities many, but this is Babylon the Great. And in this final chapters of Revelation, this picture is given of a great city, fallen as fallen, become the habitation of demons, the hold of every foul spirit and every cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Nothing like it in earth's history. Take again the signal nature of verse 10. Standing afar off, the people of the world, for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city, from one hour is thy judgment come. Such vast influence over such great times. Verse 16, saying, Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. There's nothing like that, is there, in all of the scriptures. Verse 18, and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city? Or verse 19, alas, alas, that great city, wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness. from one hour as she may desperately. All right, so there is nothing quite like that. In the 19th chapter and verse 2, it says how that she will never rise again. Verse 3, I should say, of Revelation 19. Again, they said, Alleluia, at her fall, and her smoke rose up forever and ever. That is to say, it was a consummate and total eclipse of that system and city forever. You know, so that undoubtedly is the city. We come back now to Isaiah. It's a curious and interesting thing, isn't it, to think that in the middle of Isaiah we have a section here that is so clearly ending up in the destruction of Rome. We may not have perhaps have expected that, but it shows to us how beautiful are the prophecies of God. Before Daniel, a long time before Daniel, we find this little apocalypse here in the middle of Isaiah. It says in verse 2, Thou hast made of a city a heap, of a defence city a ruin, accentuating that, a palace of strangers to be no city, it shall never be built. And therefore, says in verse 3, shall the strong people glorify thee. It emphasises the strength of this people. And then it says, the city of the terrible nations shall fear thee. Now, Rotherham says that the tyrannous nations. And the RSV has, the city of the ruthless nations shall fear thee. There's an accent upon its strength and its brutality. What's that make you think of? In a very well-known passage of Scripture, which has to do with this power and this city. Daniel chapter 2. This is the point that's noted by Daniel, isn't it, of the fourth kingdom. Daniel 2 and verse 40. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. The sheer brutality of that system is accentuated not only there in chapter 2, but also notice in chapter 7. In the seventh chapter, speaking of the same power, in verse 7 it says, After this I saw in the night visions, and behold a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong. There's our adjective. Strong exceedingly. Dreadful and terrible. Strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth, it devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. That's a very graphic description. Now there's your city of the tyrannous nations, of the ruthless nations. Now, I'll just read you a little bit here in the little book on Daniel, where a man called Anthony Trollope gave a very harrowing description of Roman cruelty. He says, That which will most strike the ordinary English reader in the narrative of Caesar is the cruelty of the Romans. Cruelty of which Caesar himself is guilty to a frightful extent and of which he never expresses horror. In describing the character of Caesar without reference to that of his contemporaries, it is impossible not to declare him to have been terribly cruel. From bloodthirstiness he slaughtered none, but neither from tenderness did he spare any. All that was done for policy. And when policy seemed to demand blood, he could, without a scruple, as far as we can judge, without a pang, order the destruction of human beings, having no regard to number, sex, age, innocence, or helplessness. Our only excuse for him is that he was a Roman and that Romans were indifferent to blood. Goes on to say, But when we come to the slaughter of whole towns, to the devastation of country effected purposely that men and women might starve, to the abandonment of the old, the young and the tender that they might perish on the hillsides, to the mutilation of crowds of men, to the burning of cities told us in a passing word, to the drowning of many thousands, mentioned as we should mention the destruction of a brood of rats. So on. Gibbon also goes on to describe the Romans as just that type of people. Now, that's the feeling that Isaiah is expressing here. It's not, you know, a beamy old smiling Pope that the world sees. This is the true and historic picture of Rome that has come through the centuries of time. So that's the city of the ruthless nations, verse 3. So we come to chapter 25 now in verse 4. And it says in an aside of encouragement to the poor and to the needy, for thou hast been, by the destruction of the strong city, thou hast been a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy in his distress. Now, my dear friends, I don't find that immediately easy to grasp hold of in my personal experience, because to you and I, we have not felt a ruthless policy toward ourselves personally. We don't quite feel the intensity of that, do we? Thou hast been a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shadow from the heat of this terrible nation, a shadow from the heat when the blast of the tyrants, it's the same as you've got in verse 3, is it a storm against the wall. Thou shalt bring down the noise of strangers as the heat in a dry place, even the heat with the shadow of a cloud. The song, not the branch, but the song of the terrible ones shall be brought low. In contrast, you see, to that other song which shall be sung in verse 9. It shall be said in that day, lo, this is our God. God brings down the song of one and he exalts the song of the saints in verse 9. But how do we sort out then verses 4 and 5? You see, there's a lot of people before our time that understand that in its full depth and power. Do you know that Rome had power over our people, and I mean by that people who had the faith of the Bible. They had essentially our understanding of the Bible. They loved the scriptures. Rome had power over that people for 1,260 years as the Holy Roman Empire. Having power, and she ravaged those people, destroying them through all of those centuries. And Daniel speaks, doesn't he, of making war against the saints for that period of time, 1,260 years. Now, what that means is the saints must have been there. You can't make war against them unless they were there. And that's some of the virtues of books like The Protesters, which has brought to light the existence of people down through the centuries who did have our understanding. But here's a man, my dear brothers and sisters, who's going to appreciate that more than you and me. This is a man called, it's a very difficult name, Tiskovicki, Jan Tiskovicki. To question or even express conscientious doubts on the doctrine of the Trinity and traditional practices associated with Catholic worship could be fraught with the greatest personal peril. Notwithstanding every effort to avoid belligerence and needless provocation of the political authorities, and in spite of a well-known policy not to irritate or anger the religious ones unnecessarily, the experience of Jan Tiskovicki shows that the possibility of becoming a faithful martyr was never far away. Tiskovicki was a citizen of some means in Bielsko, a small town 80 kilometres west of Krakow, which is where the present Pope spent most of his university years. For some reason, he was compelled to appear in the magistrate's court, something the brethren endeavoured to avoid if at all possible. No opportunity to affirm was offered, and he was ordered to hold a wooden crucifix and swear by the triune God. He quietly refused by a shake of the head and handed back the crucifix. Under the instigation of the Jesuits, he was charged with contempt of court, the blasphemy and various other offences, and his case finally reached the Supreme Court in Warsaw, capital of Poland. His appeal was dismissed, and the sentence of the royal magistrates of Queen Constantia has been preserved in a brief unsigned biographical note by one of the brethren. Quote, seeing that he has blasphemed, his tongue will be cut out. Since he has thrown down the image of the crucifix and trampled on it, his hands and feet will be cut off. Since he has held the magistrates in contempt, and because he has been stubborn, he is to be beheaded as a rebel. Finally, he is to be burned as a heretic.
Jan Dyskowicki died in the marketplace in Warsaw one cold winter's day in 1610. In fact, the sentence was not carried out precisely as specified, but the Jesuits used instead their favourite method of tearing up pieces of his flesh with red-hot pincers while he was being burnt at the stake. The magistrates never bothered with the beheading part. Speaking brethren, says the writer of this article, speaking brethren, when next we prepare a lecture on the nature of the Godhead, let us first thank God for the precious and perhaps short-lived freedom to deliver it unmolested. Now, Jan Tiskovicki is not an exception. He's just what we don't know about for 1260 years, my dear brothers and sisters. That's what Isaiah's talking about, poor and needy. Sort of people that make us feel ashamed when we think about them. We think of the kingdom and we think, well, what would you do if you met Jan Tiskovicki in the kingdom? How would you tell him about your life and mine? You know, we had an hour and a half debate as to whether we put air conditioning in the hall. Hey? We look along the rack of our clothes to see which coat we'll put on. And then our wife corrected us because we didn't have the right tie on or something. It didn't match. You know, we just live such a different world, don't we? To Jan Tiskovicki. We can go and put what we like up almost on our sign outside and preach what we like. How do we sit in the kingdom with him? I don't know how you feel about things like that, but you can count myriads of stories. I've got a little book at home. Well, I did have it at home. It's called The Israel of the Alps. Have I lent that to somebody? I went to find it tonight. I know I've given it to someone. I thought it's a good opportunity just to ask. Israel of the Alps. It's a very interesting little book. But so often in all those little pockets up among the Switzerland hills, those mountains, not hills, Alps, those little valleys that run up between the Alps, the brethren found themselves in those types of areas, Bohemia and Moldavia and so forth, where there was much mountainous country and they could sort of get into seclusion and away from the knock on the door at you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning with the papal priests leading the soldiers of the papal governments to come and pull them away to dungeon with their children and their wives and their old people. And their sin was, my dear brothers and sisters, they dared have a Bible class like you and I are having. You know, we've got it very easy, haven't we? When I think of things like that, all I can think is this, that God spare us. Spare us because we have not gone through those things. If we have done what we can, we can't change our circumstances unduly, can we? We've got to live alongside our neighbour. But what we can do is give with what we've got. We can give service. We can use all the things that we've got for his service, can't we? We can do that. But if we have all that and still don't even offer that, if we can't be blow to turn up to different things, and make a bit of stint and sacrifice for the common good. Well, then how the diggins are we going to sit next door to people like Jan Tiskovicki? We just haven't got the credentials. We just cannot understand that God's provided a shadow from the heat from a system like that. We can experience something of that if we can savour a work, a life given in support of that cause. Who are these strong and needy? These are strong that have persecuted the poor and needy. Well, here's a group of them in Revelation. They pop up through the record. Revelation chapter 6, verse 10. Verse 9, when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, this is what they cried, my dear brothers and sisters. Hurry up and bring the judgment. Hurry up. How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you let us down? Will you let us down, holy and true? Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? White robes were given unto every one. That's the people, isn't it? Chapter 16.
in the time of the vials, when through the swift sword of Napoleon, the judgment was meted out upon Catholic Europe, and it came into Central Europe, into the areas of the rivers and fountains of water, chapter 16 and verse 4. There, right in the middle of Europe, we've got the Alps, haven't we, with all of the waters flowing down from them, and that's an area, a district in Europe itself, and it's in that area that this third vial is poured forth. Third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers and fountains of water, and they became blood. And Napoleon dipped his sword in the blood of the Catholic powers, whipping them time and time again. And you know what happened? God's angel responded to that. And I heard the angel of the waters, that is the angel who was over that area, that had seen so often the blood of others, hadn't he, spilled in those valleys, unknown, undeclared, no repentance, women, children, poor and needy, lovers of the Bible, Christadelphians at heart. All they wanted to do was worship God in spirit and in truth, but they had been massacred time and time again for century after century after century. And when finally it came the turn that God turned the tables upon that wicked system and let the sword of Napoleon clean up that system in that very area, the angel of the waters responded and said, "Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art and wast and shalt be, because thou hast judged us. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy of it." And I heard another out of the altar say, "Is that not the brethren as it were themselves? Even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous." Hear the echo? "True and righteous are thy judgments." There's a link there, isn't there, with the chapter we're discussing. We'll leave it there now.